I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is David Mandel, showrunner and executive producer of the hit television comedy Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. He's joined in conversation by The Hollywood Reporter's Tim Goodman. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces David Mandel and Tim Goodman.
David Mandel is here with us this evening. He's without question one of the most hilarious and successful writers on TV, having worked on some of the most beloved comedies in TV history, including Seinfeld, SNL, and Curb Your Enthusiasm, where he also served as executive producer. In season 5, he took over as showrunner of the HBO political satire Veep from the show's creator, British writer and director Armando Iannucci, bringing his unique sensibility to the comedy series that satirizes presidential politics precisely at a historic moment when life imitates art. He also got major props from chubby Jews around the world when he dedicated Veep's Emmy win for Outstanding Comedy Series 2016 to us wherever we are. Before we hear from the man himself, appearing in conversation tonight with chief television critic of The Hollywood Reporter, Tim Goodman, and also one of the JCCSF's favorite onstage interviewers, let's take a moment to look at some highlights of David Mandel's career.
All right, boys. Let's stop in here for a second. I'm a little parched from the jog.
Sir, we've only been jogging for 3 blocks. Besides, Mrs. Clint asked us not to let you into any more fast food places.
Well, I just want to mingle with the American people, talk with some real folks, maybe get a Diet Coke or something.
All right, fine. But please, don't tell Mrs. Clinton.
Jim, let me tell you something. There's going to be a whole bunch of things we don't tell Mrs. Clinton. Fast food is the least of our worries, okay, buddy?
Hello, and welcome to Movie Fun. If you know the name of the movie you'd like to see, press 1.
Come on.
Using your touchtone keypad, please enter the first 3 letters of the movie title now. You've selected Agent Zero. If that's correct, press 1.
What?
You've selected Brown-Eyed Girl. If this is correct, press 1. Why don't you just tell me the name of the movie you selected?
Fantastic speech, ma'am.
Yeah.
Three S's, strength, stability, and bull.
Yeah, I forgot to thank the voters for making our country look like a high school Spanish club. Didn't those founding ever hear of an odd number?
2 great Greek contributions to society, democracy and getting...
I've tried both, and they're way overrated, like jazz.
Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Did you hear us laughing back there? Well, I was laughing. You've already seen all the jokes. You wrote.
I could actually hear myself laughing on the laugh track of the Seinfeld clip. I have a very distinctive laugh, and I can hear myself in Seinfeld reruns. It's very embarrassing.
That is tremendous. Yeah. That is tremendous. Well, we're here. I'm Tim Goodman, a TV critic at, used to be 10 years at the Chronicle, and now at, thank you. Chronicle still exists, right? It's still there. And now at the Hollywood Reporter, I want to tell you, we've done this a few times. Hopefully you've come out for some of the previous ones, but we're in the presence here of somebody's work who I really love. David's been on some of the probably the lowest profile and least funny shows, like, ever, right?
I mean,
like,
Some of the worst
ones.
Some of the earliest canceled shows ever.
Yeah, it's crazy. So if you look at it, SNL, Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Veep.
If it helps, I've worked on a lot of movies. So it balances out.
Well, and you know what's good for us is I have never seen those movies because I never get to
see
movies.
Please never do.
It's perfect. But that is a tremendous resume, and everything along the line has been great. And I think for so many people, and you know so many writers in Hollywood, that's not really the track that most people are on. So you must feel pretty lucky as you've gone through.
Yeah, I mean, you know, lucky also at some point in the middle there, scared of like going on to a terrible show.
Yeah.
You know, where it's just like, oh God, not a show, because obviously there are good shows and bad shows on television, as it turns out. But no, I am. I'm particularly proud of it. Yeah.
Well, I want to start with Veep, because the obvious. I think everybody in this room has probably spent the last several months just sort of their day has been unable to be completed. Any work tasks are incomplete. People are glued to the television. We are in the Trump era, and for you on a show like Veep, one of the interesting things, and I know what your answer is probably going to be for this, but one of the interesting things that people are like, oh my God, when Veep comes back. You know, what are they going to do with Trump? I think you probably have a pretty easy answer for that. So,
well, I don't know if we're really doing anything. I mean, that's the honest answer. Not to get all technical, but in the world of Veep, the latest president ever mentioned, I believe, is Reagan. Mm-hmm. And that's where sort of, I guess, like the timeline splits. Not that it's a sci-fi show in any way, shape, or form, but like we don't do weekly, you know, satire. We're not Saturday Night Live. And quite honestly, if you were trying to react to Trump and wrote a joke, and I'll give you an example, I think you would find that 6 months later, when that which you wrote kind of aired, it would just feel kind of stale and kind of very behind the times.
Right.
We actually had a joke, and I know the moment I say these words, people will giggle. We had a golden showers joke, as one can imagine. It's Veep, and there was a point where one character said to the other character something about giving them a golden shower, and we had to change the line because, obviously, the accusations of the file and whatnot. And obviously what was a sort of a funny joke would seem like a, again, six-month-old reference. So
Right. We're
not really dealing with Trump, but I'm also always happy to say that in some ways, who's more Trump than Selina Meyer? I mean, mm-hmm. if you actually think about somebody who shouldn't be president of the United States, who isn't particularly, you know, good with words, you know, has a hair-trigger temper, who last season had tweeting issues and whatnot.
Right.
We've been doing some version of the Trump show in some ways. The other character who's also somewhat very Trumpy also is Jonah, who's mm-hmm. now a congressman.
Right.
And again, not on purpose. Again, we didn't know, you know, I think we all thought we all thought someone else was going to be in the White House.
Yes, we did.
At this point, you know, we were 100% sure Jeb Bush. That's a joke.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we were doing these things, we never set out to go, let's make Jonah Trump. In some ways, we were kind of making Jonah Ted Cruz. The mm-hmm. idea of Jonah becoming a congressman was Ted Cruz is the most hated guy in the Senate. Every
right.
senator hates him.
Right.
And the idea was, well, in Congress, you have even more members. What if all 435 of them hate Jonah, basically?
Yes.
That was the goal. But again, a guy who doesn't know his issues, a guy with a real temper, who has an enemies list that's, you know, he's constantly updating, sort of swivels in the wind on issues. And again, some of this is true about Selena as well. It's all very Jonah, and we've sort of been able to kind of ride that. But again, none of it was planned. And a lot of what you saw last season and a lot of what you're going to see this season was actually all planned out 2 years ago when I first sat down with Julia to talk about taking the job when Armando
sure.
decided he was going to leave. Mm-hmm. And it was all sort of a result of the tie, which is where they had left it,
yeah.
and how are we going to resolve this tie, and what's the best version of that we can do, and then where does it go? And the progression was ultimately to take away from her the thing that she wants most, which is the presidency, and what would be the worst thing that could happen to her? Well, let's have another woman win the presidency, because she, as much as she hates everybody, she really hates women. It's one of her more charming qualities. I mean, she's really monstrous to other women, actually.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so the idea of another woman winning and that the show would then segue into this notion of former president of the United States, and we would be able to address these things that you're going to see this season, like library and stuff. But as it just happens with Veep, it's some sort of, I don't know, sometimes like a Wiccan kind of whatever. We write things, and then 8 months later, they start to happen, which is kind of creepy.
Yeah,
so
there is that track record.
Yeah, we mm-hmm. have a third episode coming up. And, I mean, the examples from last season are just endless. I mean, Nevada. I
yes.
mean, just some of that stuff mm-hmm. that he was just doing. But we have a third episode coming up this season where Selena is, as many ex-presidents do, is oversees, monitoring an election in the Republic of Georgia, which is right next to Russia. And she gets involved with these two Russian candidates, and they're very happy to offer her some money to perhaps see the election her way. Again, none of this has anything to do specifically with the Russian charges, you know, other than just greed and bribery and whatnot and lying about it. But it's going to seem to you when you see this episode like we wrote it last week as opposed to May, when I guess they were meeting with Russians but hadn't admitted it yet, or at least hadn't denied it yet.
Yeah.
So wherever you want to go. And I should preface this wherever, although I'm not sure this is going to be a huge problem here at the San Francisco JCCF. there are two separate things, which is there is the show, which prides itself on not picking sides.
Right.
We never say what party anybody's in.
Right.
If you were to like look at the lists of issues, there's no rhyme or reason. You know, we mix like, you know, pro-choice with gun control. You know, it's very willy-nilly. And in Washington, when we go there, what's wonderful is everybody thinks it's the other guy. So we meet with Republicans, and when they go, oh, it's so funny how you make fun of Democrats and vice versa. But David Mandel, Upper West Side Jew, can't stand this guy. And there's nothing funny about him, and it's horrible, and I will continue to make jokes about it. But they are two separate things. So if you are here in support of Donald Trump tonight, please enjoy the show. You can hate me. But anyway,
sorry. Well, the show has walk that line, like you said, where people just don't know.
I think
it's
very much intentional, because really, ultimately, what I think, and again, I didn't create the show. Armando created the show, and it's a credit to him. It's not about the issues. They move within the issues, I guess in some ways like Trump does, just looking for the victory. It's really as much about power and wanting power.
Right.
That's really what the show is about. It's not about one side of the aisle or the other.
Right.
Yeah.
It's never felt partisan, because it's like everybody's a buffoon of some sort.
And also an equal opportunity sort of hate across the board. Yeah.
But the interesting thing about the time that it's coming out with Trump, and you guys were ahead, and I think we went through that quickly, but season 5 kind of nailed a lot of stuff. It was like you were almost such prescience about what was happening.
Yeah, but I mean, I wish I could tell you, like, we met with someone and they told us everything.
Right.
It was just, this is the worst thing. We sat down and, you know, I have a bunch of writers, and we sat down and we think about what's the stupidest, worst thing a president could do? What's the most horrifying moment you could create? And then, unlike real life, she gets comeuppance. There doesn't seem to be any comeuppance so far, which I'm kind of waiting for. But in Veep world, at least it loops back around and she gets hoisted on her own, you know, well, petard, but not what she would say.
Right.
The point being, though, is we sat down to go like, well, what would be the funniest thing in the world? Well, what if she accidentally DM'd on Twitter her boyfriend and made, you know, a racially insensitive remark or about, I think it was about diabetes or whatever it was, and it was just like, and that's now nothing. But here's the crazy thing. Thank God that if we had that show coming up right now, like I can sit here and go, I think it's kind of cool, this sort of Russian thing that's coming up. It's a fun coincidence. I think you'll like it. If we had that Twitter story coming up right now, I guess we'd be reshooting. I don't quite know what we'd be doing, because, again, I think it would just feel old and stale. So I love being ahead of it, but I don't never want to be behind it.
Well, and that's the thing too, because it wouldn't be, you couldn't match the real thing. So in some sense, it wouldn't even be funny.
Well, I think also one of the advantages this season, or at least I'm hoping, for those of you that are watching, and if you're not, I'm sorry, I guess this is a spoiler. At the end of the season, I think people were a little shocked to see her lose the presidency, which again I don't want to put too fine a point on my original plan. It's kind of like, part of why I took the job was the chance to have her lose this presidency. And so not being in the White House, but Selena still being Selena, still craving prestige, still craving power, but having been very much pushed off to the side, we get to do a lot of what you want from Veep and what you like about Veep. But what we don't do is you don't see her in the exact same spots. She's not sitting at that desk like Trump is.
Right.
We're not. Mike McClintock is no longer the press secretary. He's out of work.
Right.
So no one's going to sit there and go, oh my God, it's just like Sean Spicer, which it is.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Spicer is more incompetent than McClintock, which didn't even seem possible. I mean, again, in our world, it's like, well, what's the worst thing a guy could do up there? Doesn't even come close. McClintock's clothing fits. I mean, I don't, you know. So, again, so it's sort of this thing of like, I think this sort of step almost not to the back, but this step to the side is only going to help us this year. And I hope, obviously, you'll dig it when you start to see more of it, obviously.
Well, it's funny because it is this weird albatross, and I know some critics have been talking about it, and a lot of – we actually have not seen – we've talked this before, have not seen the first three that we're going
to
get.
He's about to see it Monday.
About
Tuesday,
to see it, but I have not seen it, so I can't come here and, like, spoil it for you, which is probably good. But there's this thing, like, there will have to be this discussion about Trump and it not being influencing the show because it was happening either before or no one thought he was going to get in. And once we move away from that and say this is not sort of Trump-related – the bigger thing, though, is what we've been getting at up here for the last 10 or 15 minutes, which is how does it feel as a writer to look at what's happening in the real world and how it plays off of what you're doing fictionally and be stunned that that Veep, which is, I mean, I watched episodes, this is one of my favorite shows, I watched episodes of Veep and I'll die laughing and I'm thinking, this is like the awfulness in this show is so off the charts, and then you watch what's happening, you realize, you're like, well, we missed that by about...
We weren't even close.
We weren't even close. We didn't
Selena
get
has
here.
Barely begun to be anti-Semitic. I mean, you know, there's a lot of mountains still to climb. She actually has a black guy working for her. I mean, it's like she's miles ahead of
him. Yeah, there are women in the office.
No,
this
exactly.
Is
she is a woman, I think.
Yeah.
but, no, I mean, it you know, it's both... sometimes horrifying, I will say, because it does make the job harder. Again, I think our pivot, which was lucky, helps. But at the same time, I will also say, and this is more anecdotal, the fact that there is this sort of hunger, whether it's to see what we do with Trump or how we are talking about politics and the election, that people want to laugh, that things are so, I guess, for lack
they
of
are,
a better word.
They are, yes,
that I no. guess that's a, I guess... that sort of does the heart good of sort of the fact that people want the show back. And also, for us, it kind of empowers us to kind of go further. And I don't mean further necessarily specifically like trying to outrage what they do, but to hopefully find a really funny way to cut through it so that we're commenting on it without commenting on it.
Right. And just to be clear, prior to this season, did you sit down with the writers and say... to address Trump in any way of like saying how do
no,
we
no I mean again
it, you wrote of, it, way in
it
advance.
Started to come up last year I guess when we were doing press for the show so if you think about it, last year's show premiered right around April and so he was winning but hadn't locked it up yet so that's when the questions basically started coming at us, and like I said, our sort of simple answer was, well, look at Jonah, look at Selena, and those are still true things. And we definitely talked about the beginning of the season. I'll tell you something else. We were shooting the last night of that Russian Georgian episode that I was mentioning. We were shooting the actual voting station. We were in a location where it was supposed to be a Georgian voting station with like UN people and the people, you know, where they dip their thumb in the color to show that they voted and the whole thing. And so we're trying to film this thing and be funny as the returns are coming in that night.
Yeah.
And we don't even have a television. We're on the internet, which is so much worse. Because on the television, there's jibber-jabbering kind of as the returns are coming in. This is just like, it's just like her chances, 90%, 70%, 55%, 49%, you know, 33%. If, you know, if Alaska, Arizona, you know, it just like, it was just body blow, you know, just whatever. And it was genuinely hard to be funny. And we definitely, luckily, were going into a hiatus where we could stop for a day or two and kind of go, let's think about what we have coming up. What are we doing? And, it was just a moment to kind of sort of check ourselves. And the good news was, I think this is all still good, but also even maybe some of this is even in some ways more insightful, because in some ways, because she doesn't have power and is trying to sort of be a big shot as a former president, in some ways, you see a lot of Trump's worst, sort of, if you will, his qualities in her, again, even though it's not in the White House. So again, it's trying to find ways of attacking that aren't perfectly spot on, but hopefully by the end of it, Whatever. And the other good thing is, I don't, in a million years, I think if he watched, he'd have no idea anyway. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
You're listening to David Mandel, showrunner and executive producer of the hit television comedy Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. He's joined in conversation by The Hollywood Reporter's Tim Goodman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, it's interesting, too. You talked about taking out the... So you took out the
golden showers. We did. We took out the golden showers thing, yes.
What does it say that we live in a world where you have to take that out?
No, that's exactly it. We're like, honestly, the real... I mean, that is part of it that sort of... You know, we sort of had a joke. Julia had a joke, I think, when she accepted... I don't remember. Some award that she won. She wins a lot in a good way.
Yeah, she does.
Where she said something that the show started off as this sort of satire and had become a sobering documentary. That was her line.
Yeah.
And we sort of, one of the jokes that we've had this year is that now the show is going to be, our version of parody is going to be, the show is going to be about a very competent president who's really smart and internationally respected. So, you know, I'm not sure that's exactly fun to watch, but by the way, you know, I think... And we've been talking a lot about this with writers and other people too, which is, you know, I think we go in cycles, and I think, you know, Veep is a product of cynicism, and maybe because now the world is a little darker, perhaps the next political show will be a return to like more of a West Wing kind of there is hope. I'm not saying I'm not going to do that show, but I'd watch it. I would watch it. But you know, it is that hard thing where, you know, where you're sitting there going like, oh, you know, two girls peeing on you. Oh, we can't do that. The president said that last week. I mean, I have no good answer. You know what I mean? It's just sort of like, how did we get here? You know, is this what the founders had in mind? You know,
it does seem particularly
challenging. Certainly Jefferson, if you know what I mean. But
it does seem particularly challenging for writers at that point to sit there and say,
I'm making myself laugh. I hope you're all enjoying that.
How do we top, as writers saying, how do we top the real thing? And then I think you're going to definitely move through that.
And I don't think you top it, but I do think you attack it. That's the hope.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
And can you give us, just since no one, including I, have seen it, where are we starting in season six? What's happening?
Basically, we're picking up post, there's a little bit of time since basically the end of last season, where when we last saw her, which was that shot, you basically saw her sitting in the middle of a field having lost. And so we're going to pick it up, and I think some of the fun, which I think people will get a kick out of, is sort of seeing where everyone is. Because besides, you know, where's she going, it's also sort of when you work for the losing candidate, your resume is not exactly on the top of the pile.
Right.
And so we're going to get a chance to see who's still with her, who's not with her, who's moved on. And, of course, Jonah, who is a successful congressman, is oddly at the top of his game, which is always sort of enjoyable when Selena's sort of down and he's sort of up. Although we are going to also find out at the end of the season there he got sort of a little cancer scare, and we find out the results of that as well. So we kind of pick it up down the line a little bit in a good way to kind of sort of see the new sort of situations of everybody. And then really it is starting to be about, and I've sort of, one of the things that I am excited about is that we have Obama, who just signed a giant book deal for like, you know, a lot of money with his wife, is trying to raise I think they said close to $1 billion for his library. These are the things, what, you know, as watch what Obama's doing, because it, very much this is also a lot of what Selena is going to be doing this year as she tries to define her post-presidency. Is she going to be, you know, an activist like a Jimmy Carter? Is she going to go for the money like the Clinton Foundation? Or, you know, in perfect Selena world, go for the money but make people think you're an activist.
Right.
So, you know, and so a lot of it are those challenges. So I think that's a lot of what you're going to see.
Right. And tell me how different it was for this season. And I do want to circle back to that meeting about planning out five and six. The idea of having everybody kind of go in different directions, what challenges did those pose?
Well, I mean, it's very different because, you know, obviously, first of all, we lost our home base.
Yeah.
You think about the Oval still exists, but there's a different occupant. And you will see Montez this season, President Montez. And there are things that brings Selena back to visit the White House, sure. which is not a fun experience for her in right. any way, shape, or form. But we lost our home base. So some of it, just from the get-go, was like, where is she?
Yeah.
Like, she could be anywhere. Where is she? And
right.
I don't think I'm ruining anything. She's in New York City, sort of leading sort of the slightly more sort of Bill Clinton-esque cosmopolitan lifestyle kind
right.
of a thing, or at least trying to. So that was, you know, those were just some of the most basic challenges of like, where is she? Where is everybody? And of course, if everybody's now separated, more scenes, more to juggle, more
sure.
storylines, which was really fun to do because when it can work and you can have these stories up in the air and figure out that sort of wonderful way to have them intersect, I that's the kind of, I guess, you know, if you look back, if you will, on like Seinfeld and Curb, maybe did it more to the extremes. And I'm not saying everything's going to perfectly end in one scene
sure.
in a Curb way, but seeing people in these new sort of walks of life and how they're now interacting is really interesting. And the real truth of the matter is none of these people, I mean, forget about how incompetent they all are working for her. They all
right.
would have been fired. But the truth of the matter is there is a sort of, I think, an expiration date on an actual Washington, D.C. employee.
Mm.
Like, nobody works for a president. Like, nobody would have stayed with a vice president truly for her entire vice presidency and then whatever.
And the
presidency, they do move
yeah.
on. Mm-hmm. So I actually think there's an added dose of reality to sort of seeing how our characters are trying to move on in a really, hopefully, funny way.
But also, and just
yeah.
if people don't know this, or I'm sure this is a savvy bunch, and they probably do know that, that most television shows absolutely do not want to do that. They're like, we have our thing, we're going to do it every week the same way, and it will go on and, you know, you don't
I will,
want to do that.
No, I will, I'm the first to say that I think, and again, you know, I don't know how diehard you people are, but as it got into the back end of last season, and she lost the presidency, and we sort of fainted very hard towards the notion of she's going to be Tom James's vice president. I think, if I had to guess, I would think 90% of our audience probably figured that that's what was going to happen, and 90% of that 90% were very excited by that idea and thought that would be a great show.
Yeah.
It's a fine show, but guess what? They did it. It was called Veep. It was seasons 1 through 4. I understand that Tom James would be the new element, but at some point, you do run out of sort of like, there's something wrong with her speech, and
sure.
I'm not trying to belittle it in any way, shape, or form, but I am just a big believer in sort of, I guess, like, to me, shows have to be like sharks. They have to kind of keep moving. Again, I think we could have easily figured out a way to keep her president or make her vice president. Those were not enjoyable to me, and
sure.
they weren't from the get-go, both in terms of, A, surprising people with something that they didn't think could ever happen.
Right.
As Julia likes to say, we blew up the show. But in
yeah.
some ways, the show has blown itself up before. I don't think people ever expected her to become president
right.
the way she did. And then I don't think people were expecting the tie. So to me, it was part and parcel with what they'd done in the past to radically shake it up and take it to the place you didn't know and then do a show about former president of the United States and start seeing what that is. It is one of those things. But I will also tell you that I was there when Larry David decided to kill Susan.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't do that either. Do you know what I mean? So, I learned from the best.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And I do. Well, we'll certainly get to that. But just I want to finish up some
yeah,
stuff
sorry,
because
no.
the on the that whole like shows don't do this, but the really great shows try to keep reinvigorating themselves. There's a pattern in your career, but let's start with Veep. Is you know, here was a show where Arnaldo Iannucci is just brilliant, brilliant writer, creator, show creator. This thing existed. It was kind of at the peak. Julia was winning all these awards. The show was...
And I was a huge fan. I mean,
yeah.
Wherever that fits in. I mean, that was a show, you know, like part of that Sunday night that like, you
oh,
know,
yeah.
like not, in a perfect world, not like TiVo'd 5 days later, but Sunday night, you know, watch it with my wife. So
absolutely.
I was a fan. I was there watching, yeah.
So what kind of pressure was there when you came in to take over? And you know, the fast forward to that story, I want to hear what happened. But the fast forward is this fifth season was fantastic, and it took it to a new heights. That almost never happens. You won an Emmy at the end of it. That almost really never happens when someone takes over a show that's in its longer period. So how much pressure was it just exciting for you to
say? The good news is I didn't think too much about it. When I sat down with Julia, she very quickly told me about the tie. And that just, like, I can only say the writer in me sort of the challenge of that tie was just like the notion of this constitutional crisis, a tie in the Electoral College. I got very excited by that. So right from the get-go, I started thinking about solving that problem without even thinking about, oh, what am I doing? And the interesting thing was I didn't think much about it as we were doing it. There was definitely, there was sort of the Sunday night when, like, it was like the Sunday night before our first table read when they won an Emmy for season 4, where I definitely said to myself, what am I doing here? And then we kind of got back to it and kind of, you know, and I knew what we were doing was good. And I knew, for me, if I'd gone, I don't know if this will make sense, but if I'd gone in to try and just do Armando's show, you'd have hated it, I'd have hated it, I've hated myself, which is relatively easy for me. but it just would have been awful, like a bad mimeograph or some kind of like, you know, crooked, mushy Xerox or something. And so I knew I was going to bring what I wanted to bring to the show, but, you know, his show, but me.
Right.
And I knew the episodes were good, and I knew there were things we were doing, things that he didn't do. None of this is ever a criticism of him. It was just sort of, these are things that are interesting to me.
Sure.
I wanted to dig a little bit more, especially because I felt like it was season 5, who these people are a little bit. So we definitely had a little bit more private life. Mm-hmm. And then there are issues and things that I was surprised that they never tackled as much. The British are very sensitive when it comes to race. Mm-hmm. And so race was not something they did a lot with. And I think that's something that is a part of our season last year, just as a running commentary, which I very much wanted to do in Barack Obama's America,
sure,
to sort of talk about it. So there were things like that. I think as an American, as a former government major, as sort of a student of history, I think we brought more American historical references into the show because they didn't know them. You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah,
but
it was kind of interesting.
We did more of them. But very much, you know, I wanted the show to be mine. What I will say is, and I don't specifically remember any one in particular, but when the shows went out to the world and we started to get the first reviews, and basically every review sort of started with, shows are terrible when the guy who created them leaves and whatever. That is when I actually truly realized how terrible people were prepared for it to be.
Mm-hmm.
And again, thank God I didn't think about it, I think, is a good thing. And by the way, all comedy writers, I think all writers, but I think comedy writers especially, we have egos. You know, there's very much in any sort of situation, like, that guy's funny. That guy's not funny.
Yeah.
That guy, he's really not funny. you know, and whatever. And so my thought, you know, you don't go into it going, well, Armando was so funny, I'm never going to be able to do as well. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you
want
to stop it.
No,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But you don't, I also didn't go in like he's not funny.
Right.
It's just, it didn't occur to me until it occurred to me.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. The confidence obviously showed, and the change invigorated the show and took it to new heights, and you got a lot of credit for that. And obviously the Emmy at the end was fantastic. But you've had a history sort of coming in. I mean, like Seinfeld, right?
The difference with Seinfeld, at least, though, was a show that I was hired as a working writer,
sure, mm-hmm,
and then sort of rose up within the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Veep, having not even worked a day, having really sort of met Armando, like I think we met in a writer's room once, and then years later, on a movie, we met each other. And then sort of the next thing I know, I'm on the phone with him. You know, like that was very different, I think, in terms of the typical sort of thing. Yeah.
So take us through, because I...
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
No, it's just this is fascinating. You look at the resume, and usually people have a huge pitfalls. You joke about the movies, but I haven't seen the movies, so that's fine.
Some of them are really terrible.
But take me through going through SNL and to Seinfeld, and then into Kurt. And it's, for a critic, when I look at that, that's like, these are gold standard shows all the way through.
I mean, they were, for me, Saturday Night Live was really, I mean, just to start there, I guess, that was truly, I guess, if you had sort of found, like, and again, I'm not sure I knew you could be a comedy writer, so I'm not sure if you went to 16-year-old me, I would have said, like, I'm going to be a comedy writer. I think I would have said, like, well, I'll be a lawyer, but hopefully I'll get to be a lawyer that deals with movies. I just didn't know. I was a comedy nerd. I loved stand-up albums and all that kind of stuff, and I read every book I could and read the official backstage history of Saturday Night Live by Hill and Weingard, which is must reading. So But so Saturday Night Live for me, I mean, the two places I always wanted to work once I figured out I wanted to work was I wanted to work either at Saturday Night Live or Letterman. Those were the two for me that were the very much the defining sort of like on my comedy psyche kind of a thing. And I was lucky enough to work at Saturday Night Live. I started there basically the August after I graduated from college, and it was 3 years, but they're Saturday Night Live, they're like dog years because we would basically sleep there a couple of nights a week. Mm-hmm. And I was very lucky enough. I was brought in by Al Franken, now Senator Al Franken,
who's, which is also really weird, right?
My mentor, basically. Al sort of found me and brought me to SNL. Al and I co-wrote the Clinton McDonald sketch. That was one of the first things we wrote. That was probably the January right before the inauguration of my first year at SNL. We wrote that together, and I love that sketch. And I got to basically learn, basically sitting next to Al Franken and another guy named Jim Downey, who is the longtime head writer and producer of SNL.
Yeah.
Just two of the funniest guys on earth, and with apologies to Al, dare I say, Jim Downey's probably the funniest human being on earth.
Yeah.
And actually, we got him for an episode. This is a spoiler alert. he's going to be playing a part in the season finale of Veep. So episode 10, Jim Downey, you might recognize him if you remember the old Change Bank sketch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do we make money? Volume. We can give you – a man came in with a $10 bill. We could give him two $5 bills or 10 ones. Anyway, that's Jim Downey. And he did a little cameo for us. But anyway, and I basically that was my that was my learning experience. I'm a better writer because of my 3 years there. By the time those 3 years were done, I had to get out of there, and I was on my way out the door regardless when I got the opportunity. Larry offered me the Seinfeld job, which obviously, even if I hadn't been out the door, I would have been out the door for that.
Yeah, definitely.
And then, you know, my first year of Seinfeld under Larry, because I was there basically for his last year. That's where I learned to write sitcoms. I mean, the first
because you were coming from mostly putting sketches
together.
Yes,
I was writing
five-minute
sketches, or I guess SNL in those days probably they were too long. They were like 10-minute sketches.
But anyway, you get the idea. Yeah, exactly.
But I can remember putting up my first outline. You know, we work on a lot of like dry erase boards.
Yeah.
I had up my first outline for the episode that was, it was the pool guy, it was called. And so the stories were, and the way you sort of did the way you did Seinfeld was you would basically come up with ideas and go to Larry and Jerry and pitch, and basically pitch stories for the characters until you had four stories, or in a perfect world, maybe a story that had two characters in it.
Right.
And so in that episode, and this was and all the great Seinfeld episodes, in my opinion, are based on things from somebody's life.
Right.
All of mine have stuff from my life. So in that episode, there's Jerry at his health club. The guy who gives him his towel becomes too friendly with him. And it's sort of a class distinction thing. And that was based on my childhood friend Larry Schwartz, who joined a club in New York City, one of these fancy athletic clubs, and a kid from our high school who was our year was working there as the towel guy. And so I sort of, took that and then turned it into that. So that was that story.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features David Mandel, showrunner and executive producer of the hit television comedy Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. He's joined in conversation by The Hollywood Reporter's Tim Goodman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
George and Elaine are together in a story, which is basically Elaine has no female friends and becomes friendly with Susan, and that drives George and the rest of the group crazy, which was based on friends in college and his girlfriend sort of horning into our little male world and whatnot. And then Kramer did the movie Phone, which was based also, believe it or not, on two guys I went to college with, and the school had like an in-house system where the number was 493 and then four more digits, but if you were dialing another student, you didn't have to dial the 49, so you just dialed 3. And in Boston, movie phone was 333 film as opposed to 777 film. So if you didn't hit the 9 to get out of the system and dialed 333 film, you got their room. And again, that was a funny story, but obviously you take that and you turn it into something else. So you would get your four stories approved.
Tremendous, by the way.
And then you have your four stories. And then I outlined what was just the most fantastic first act of a sitcom you've ever seen.
Right.
Just fantastic. And Larry and Jerry came in and basically took my entire act, what easily was 11 minutes of comedy gold, and just stepped on it like they were shoving trash into a garbage bag. And basically my 11 scenes kind of became two scenes.
Right.
And then I did more, and they kind of came in and shoved it down again. And then basically what that does is, first of all, every scene has moves all stories.
Right.
That golden rule of writing, anybody here ever wants to write, if you're writing a scene, especially in a TV show, movie, sitcom, whatever, make sure things are moving forward. Even the greatest jokes in the world, just keep it moving forward.
Yes.
And Seinfeld, we're moving two, three stories along in a scene at a time, but everything is moving forward. And you start to realize when you look at other sitcoms how they just stall. The classic sitcom just stall a lot. Now, when it's I Love Lucy, it can be a delightful stall. A lot of the Jim Belushi shows, it's not quite so delightful. So that was lesson one, was sort of shoving it in, shoving it down, keep everything moving. The other thing that happens is where a normal sitcom might end, where you might have ended, is now your third or fourth scene, which now forces that additional thinking of where is this going in a way that whatever, because again, another show, they argue, they make up, and that's the show ends.
Yeah.
And so these were sort of the foundations of how to outline these shows that I sort of think back on a daily basis.
Right.
And by the way, you have to have that outline. That's I love great improv. We do a lot of improv as part of Veep. But when you see people who just think improv is, I've got a camera, we've got a kitchen, let's just see what happens. No, that's not improv. That's just a mess.
You need,
it's the outline. And that's the thing people don't understand is, if you took what we had on a Curb episode, one of those outlines, I swear to God, I could write the script in a night based on that outline.
Because
it's just filling in. And obviously jokes would change, but it's all there.
Yeah.
Because it's not about the joke, it's about the story. And I think that's what people forget. There was this really interesting thing on YouTube, and I think you can find it. I don't know if you've ever seen it, where they took different sitcoms and removed the jokes. Have you ever seen that?
No, I have not seen that.
So they did this to a couple of different sitcoms. And when you do that, and this is not a bad thing, but when you do it to the Big Bang Theory, there's nothing left. It's hey, I got a new couch. That's what's left. That's not a bad thing. I'm just simply saying they're not story-driven. They are joke-driven.
Joke-driven,
and Friends, you get three or four minutes.
Yeah.
But with Seinfeld and obviously Curb, there's a lot of genuine story there, of which on Curb and on Seinfeld, for time, and this happens on Veep all the time, we'll cut jokes, which seems counterintuitive. But you cut jokes because the stories and the situations are hopefully so good that they're inherently funny and the individual joke doesn't matter. And I think, again, that's all of that stuff is what I tried to bring over to Veep.
And that's also a huge difference from, say, a network comedy, which is, set up, punchline, and then a huge joke right before the commercial.
Yes.
And then you get into these cable shows that you worked on, basically. Well, Seinfeld was sort of a pre-cable show.
But certainly an influence. I mean, Seinfeld sort of seems like the single-camera sitcom that wasn't, if you will.
Exactly, exactly. People are still surprised when there's a
laugh track.
On it. Yeah,
just proscenium,
Yeah, it's very odd. But now that we have this body of work that we certainly talked about, one of the things is I look at your, and I'm not, this is it's probably going to come out wrong, but it's really hilariously vicious in some way, but knowingly and pointed. And so some ways when you got to Veep, because Armando's sense of humor is very much like that too, with the thick of it in England and stuff, that just sort of level of whatever. How would you put spin on it? Because there's a little bit of it in that all those shows.
There's certainly viciousness, but it's not vicious. That's the thing is, it's attacking, but for me it's just simply about the comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's what is the funniest joke I can do in this spot.
Right.
And I don't care what it is, and I'm offended by nothing. I'm offended by nothing.
Yeah.
So I don't care. And I don't care if you're offended either. Grow up.
Right.
That's just the truth. And it doesn't mean that all jokes have to be offensive, because you can have great physical comedy, great other just funny misunderstanding situations. But it is simply, and again, this was so different, I guess, being even on Seinfeld and the rest of what was going on sort of on NBC, which is all Larry and Jerry cared about was the funny.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all they cared about ever.
Right.
And that's what they taught me and some of the others. And that's what we, and then certainly Curb, all he cared about was the funny. And in some ways, the truly not caring is the fact that he's happy to play like a rich guy. I mean, he's basically, you know, in the version of himself, he's a rich guy with rich guy problems. And if you can't relate to that, he doesn't care, and neither do I.
Right, exactly.
Enjoy it for what it is. Right. He's not saying his life is better than yours.
Right.
You're just seeing a little slice of it.
Yeah.
And then, again, taking that sort of into Veep, and by the way, I think Armando certainly set up a certain thing, but I think Julia sort of really, sort of, that is her code, and that I think is where we find so much of our common ground, which is just, you know, killing each other and, you know, killing anyone in our way, again, to just make it, like, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's sort of some famous, I don't know, like, saying from, like, that Michael O'Donohue, the old Saturday Night Live writer, always, like, quoted, which some sort of Assassin's Creed of, like, everything is permitted. And I don't have that on a plaque or anything like that, but I am truly a believer, which is, again, and we're not going to say on the show just to say it. We're going to say it if we can do it exquisitely and in a way that really lands. And, in fact, we will go through and cut out random to save it for the moment where the really punches you in the face in a good way.
Yeah.
But again, so it's because I think it is easy to dismiss the show as, oh, it's filthy. But it can be, but it also, it's so much more. And again, it's the quest for the comedy. And so, you know, like when Larry did that Muhammad Atta, like, box cutter joke, there's no one else on earth that would do that joke.
Right.
And that often happens with Julia. Julia's willingness to be so horrible as Selena, for example, to her daughter, to Catherine, and some of these things, there's no one else on earth. There's no man or woman. Let's be clear about this. I'm not just talking about, like, oh, put her in a category of female comedians or something. Yeah. I'm talking about anybody that is willing to have so much dumped on her and to be so horrible and not care if you like her or not, and yet oddly make her unlikableness likable.
Yeah.
And so the greatest thing in the world is, on any rational level, you should be thrilled that she's no longer president, but everyone feels really bad for her, even though when she loses, she's horribly mean to Gary and everyone else around her. And the more horrible she is, the more you should hate her, yet you're feeling bad for her, and because that's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I mean, she can do that. But again, it is that quest for, that there is no network. Network notes are stupid. Like, you know, Seinfeld was created in a vacuum.
Right.
We have a great situation with HBO where they are not network people. They actually give notes that, like, are matter and, like, you know, and mean something. And, again, it's that just to sort of go, what is the funniest thing we can do? That's all that matters. We don't have an agenda. We don't have a political agenda. If you're making a comedy and you're not worried about the comedy, I don't know what you're doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And you should be fearless. And I think one of the things that I like about the trajectory you went on is that the humor I found is that it was so awkward and cringy, and you were literally backing up on your couch thinking, like, oh my God, this
I know people that cannot watch it.
Oh, absolutely,
because
it
makes them.
It's really
that moment where he goes, one other thing, almost like, you know, and they just go, oh.
I was always, like, curled up on the couch, just like, oh, he's not going to do that. Because, you know, he was always going to go there. What I love, that's the cringy show, which I love. But when you got onto Veep, it was totally in my wheelhouse because there was a lot of anger, and there's a lot of swearing, and anger and swearing done with, like, the sublime level that you guys did it of humor is perfect. And I can watch Selena be awful at people constantly, and the characters are just so awful. Like, some of just the teasers for this season, rewatching it, I think I watched that sizzle reel from HBO like three or four times before I even came here, because I just would play it again because everybody is so dourly mean and upset about everything that happened. I just love that level.
Oh, good.
But I want to leave on a kind of a positive note. Do you think, because we circle back to this Trump thing, do you think that this level of people who are much more interested in because they have to, because they're scared about politics. Is there a possible driver where people who are much more politically active in their brains right now, because even if they didn't want to, will come to this, come to Veep?
I mean, I think hopefully a lot of them were watching already, but I do think people, I mean, I think, I guess if I were to think what HBO is thinking, they're hoping people seek it out, that a lot of people have become, whatever, more politically activated or wake or woke or whatever the hell, right? Whatever.
Yeah, woke. Woke. That's what the kids say.
They're woke now, whatever. Yeah. So I think they are hoping that, which, you know, I guess for me, I do think, and I don't know if this answers your question either, but I do think there is, getting rid of the language aside, the notion of sort of, and again, we're not necessarily doing parody per se, but the notion of satire, and certainly dark satire, is, it's a wonderful tradition in this country and in obviously a lot of places. If you go back to, you know, colonial times, like if you go back, I guess, to like even like the early parties forming, like some of like the missives, the back and forth, the public writings that were signed by sort of assumed names, you know, with Hamilton and Jefferson, whatever, they're funny and they're vicious and whatever. And so I just think there's a, that I, not to, again, like we're serving, you know, the greater good, but I just think there's something so important about being able to still laugh at what's going on in Washington, D.C. So I guess that's my little hope.
Yeah, I think people do need a laugh. That's great. Well, first of all, before we close things up, I want to say that I was really happy to do this tonight, and I hope you were happy to hear it, because David is one of those sort of, well, he's sung now. I was about to say unsung, but you got to hold an Emmy finally, and there are many times you should have won it, many times for writing, but he
is
fantastic. Yeah, see? Yes, very true. Should have won it for writing many, many times, but... as a TV critic, I can say this is one of the great ones, so hopefully you had a good time coming out tonight. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was David Mandel, showrunner and executive producer of the hit television comedy Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. He was joined in conversation by The Hollywood Reporter's Tim Goodman. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.